You guys hear me on both sides? All right. When Jimmy invited me to do this a few months ago, I thought he was kidding, because I am not a poet. The last time I wrote poetry was in 1978. I was trying to get one of those elusive North Philly chapter NAACP scholarships for college. And I had lots of scholarship money already, but I wanted to suck up as much, free scholarship money floating around Philadelphia as I could. And I figured that, I was a lock for this poetry competition because I was literate as a 12th grader. And usually the winners of these contests, especially the North Philly chapter of the NAACP, the winners usually just cribbed from Maya Angelou or some other famous poet and got away with it. And I thought, well, I'll do original stuff and really blow their minds because, I'm the black T.S. Eliot, I put together a whole bunch of what I thought were imagistically dense but fascinating and lyrical poetry. And I was really in a heavy Leonard Cohen, Bob Dylan mode at the time with a little dash of Steely Dan. And I just thought, I'm really going to win this thing. And there were five of us who were in this competition. And I thought, look at these people. They look really stupid. I'm going to really win this thing. So, when they announced the results, they announced my name first. But because it was reverse order, I was in last place. So that was the last time I wrote poetry. Then Jimmy says, hey, why don't you come here and, read some poetry with me on? And I just thought, whatever, man, sure, I agreed to it. And then as the day approached, it was like, well, shit, what am I going to do? Maybe I should crib some poetry from someone or something. Or maybe I should read some of that imagistically dense stuff that I did, back in 1978. But then I thought, no, I'm not gonna do that. And because it's one of Jimmy's things, I thought the place would probably be crawling with cops or gangsters. And so I thought, let me read a column or two that might have some poetic pretensions, some columns that maybe some of you who may not be familiar with my work will be completely unfamiliar with. And even those who are familiar with my work may have forgotten this stuff mercifully. So I'm going to read at least two columns, one from February 23rd, 2001, and it was called The Man and the Wheel Well. The man found dead in the wheel well of the U.S. Airways jet earlier this week probably never wanted to be a metaphor. San Francisco International Airport authorities believe the man, described as a 30-year-old Afro-Caribbean, boarded the 767 at London's Gatwick Airport on Sunday. He was found nearly a day later in the frigid darkness of the 15-by-20-foot chamber that houses the landing gear, a green, grease-covered parka believed to belong to the stowaway, was found on a tarmac of Pittsburgh International Airport, the first stop in the plane's journey from London to San Francisco. We know the man was arrested at Gatwick on Sunday for breaching airport security, but he was released after making bail. We don't know what his intentions were. He could have been a thrill seeker trying to see the world on the cheap, or an illegal alien who never calculated the cost of stowing away in the airless belly of a plane crossing the Atlantic in winter. Whatever his intentions, he's dead now. As far as the authorities are concerned, he's a carcass without a clue, a dead man who had only the scantiest notion how unforgiving his odyssey would be. There was some joking in a newsroom about it. "That's a Darwin Award winner for sure," someone said, referring to those who improve our chances of advancing to the next stage of evolution by removing themselves from the gene pool. Because of his hubris, nobody felt sorry for the man in the wheel well. Anyone who thinks he can survive with little or no air in a freezing, unpressurized crawl space thousands of feet above the ground is making a statement: I'm more than human. Though an absurd death, the metaphoric possibilities that come from dying in a greasy wheel well makes even such a demise more meaningful. One thinks of Icarus standing on the prison tower of Crete, tentatively stepping into the void on wings made of wax and bird feathers. Just like Icarus catching that first updraft, the man in the wheel well was probably exhilarated as U.S. Airways Flight 741 taxied down the tarmac. He'd outsmarted the authorities at Gatwick, who had caught him earlier in the day, but his heart had to be racing as vibrations from the plane rumbled around him. It was quite a moment for him when Flight 741 was finally airborne. He was finally beyond pinching by the authorities, surrounded by the deafening darkness. Did he blink back tears of relief as cold air rushed in to occupy his space? Did he say a prayer as the landing gear retracted, temporarily dispersing heat from the vulcanized tires into the cramped space around them? Was the smell of hydraulic fluid a small enough price to pay for a free ride above the clouds? Did the man in the wheel well know anything about Pittsburgh, the next stop in Flight 741's journey, or was San Francisco his intended destination? Crossing thousands of miles above the Atlantic wasn't going to be a picnic with thin, metallic-tasting air to breathe. How many times did he drift in and out of sleep, hallucinating about a new life in America? With the temperature in the space eventually dipping to minus 60 degrees, he would have been warmer standing on an Arctic summit wearing a windbreaker. How many times did he mutter, "I can handle this," in the darkness? When did he know that his green parka wasn't going to be enough? Above him, in the pressurized warmth of the cabin, life went on. Passengers partook of the rituals of transatlantic flight, oblivious to the presence of a man who would be Icarus, freezing to death below them. Meals were served, movies were watched, alcohol was consumed, books were read, toilets were flushed. As for the man in the wheel well, he probably dreamed of one last feast as his life ebbed away in frozen increments. He wouldn't be as lucky as the man who survived a similar flight from French Polynesia to Los Angeles in the wheel well of a plane last summer. He wouldn't be as lucky as the Romanian found barely alive in the bottom of a jet in Munich last year either. He ended up like most stowaways who would have done the same, who've done the same in recent years, dead, like Icarus, who fell to Earth after flying too close to the sun. He died pursuing a dream, but it didn't matter. His heart may have been in San Francisco, but he dropped his parka in Pittsburgh. I'm going to read you something a little lighter. One of the things about being a columnist is that you get to bring your family into, you get to write about your family, especially when your sons are too young to object because they don't read the paper, and your wife doesn't read the paper either. So you can get away with a lot of stuff. So this is from This is Tuesday, August 15th, 2000. It's 3 in the morning, and you hear a discussion you want no part of in the next room. In hushed tones, your wife explains the inevitability of death to your three boys, one of whom is crying. You're a father, but you're not exactly sitcom material, so you lie in bed pretending to be asleep. Bill Cosby is the only man who was able to say something clever about death of a family pet. The comedian once conducted a funeral for a goldfish in the backyard while his sitcom children looked on. We who watched in record numbers couldn't decide whether a funeral for a goldfish was a case of infinite compassion or another example of 80s era excess. But for the record, your boys won't go along with anything that requires dressing up in their Sunday best. As much as they love the hamster squealing near death in its glass cage, they never bothered to name it. Last month, the cat gobbled up your oldest son's gerbil, thus ending months of frustration that had been building since Christmas. The gerbil's twin died alone and heartbroken 2 weeks later. Now this thing with the keening hamster, your house is beginning to feel like something out of Stephen King's Pet Sematary. Your hamster is very sick. He's making that noise because he's in a lot of pain, your wife says to one of the twins. She's building her case slowly. Even Paris can see what's coming. I know, Mom, he says between tears. I just don't want him to die. Everyone's sleep has been interrupted several times by the hamster's high-pitched squealing. It was an sound, a distant relative of the rebel yell last heard during the Civil War. Yes, it's very sad, Paris. Life is that way, she says. We'll have to put your hamster to sleep now, okay? You lie in bed listening and wondering, who has the smoother bedside manner, Dr. Kevorkian or your wife? You keep your ear cocked for the sound of the garbage compactor grinding tiny bones, gristle and fur. No, Ma! No, Ma! Love him, Paris says. Though his mother had been the hamster's primary caretaker for 2 or 3 years. You try to think of a quip worthy of a sitcom dad and address the recent spate of animal deaths and misery in our home. How about Munchausen by Foxy? Nah, too obscure for the kids. So you opt out. You opt to say, stay under the covers and say nothing. Yeah! There it goes again. Your wife reaches into the hamster cage and is bitten. Your boy cries like someone stuck a gun to Lassie's head. You scrunch further under the covers. You hear your wife patiently explaining the humane death she has planned for the nameless hamster. She grabs a towel from under the bathroom sink, gently wraps it around the animal, and stuffs it into a blue recyclable giant eagle bag. She then walks down the back stairs and puts the bag in the freezer, part of the refrigerator between the frozen waffles and the ice cube tray. If all goes well, the hamster will drift into eternal sleep. You wonder if you'll hear it keening through the freezer door like the denouement of some Edgar Allan Poe story. Several hours later, your wife checks the freezer. The hamster is still breathing, though its ears are beginning to stiffen. She loosens the insulation around the animal and closes the freezer door. She and the boys camp out on the sofa and in sleeping bags on the living room floor, waiting for the hamster to die. When you return home from work, you're surprised to find the hamster long dead, still stuffed in the freezer. Your wife is cooking pasta for two high school friends and their husbands. Everyone's standing in the kitchen. You're feeling mischievous. So you tell them about the frozen critter. They laugh even while eyeing the meatballs a little more closely than they would have before. Your wife says she's been too busy running around being a good hostess to bury the hamster. When asked if she planned a funeral for it, she just stares. She's not a sitcom wife by a long shot. She's frazzled and sleep-deprived. Meanwhile, your boys have already forgotten about their beloved hamster. They've been bought out with promises of new Warhammer 40,000 action figures. The guests take turns peeking at the blue giant eagle bag in the freezer, admiring your wife's moxie and wondering if they could ever do such a thing. Oh, there was another line or two that must have gotten cut off, and I don't remember what it was, but that's the end. I don't know, we have time for one more? All right. Back in 1998, I had been a columnist for about 2 years. And, and I wrote about a lot of social justice issues and so forth. And I was getting hate mail from all the right people. But I had never written about gay folks or their struggles and so forth and so on. And so, and then along came the outrageous Matthew Shepard affair, what happened to that young man who was crucified by some homophobes. It takes me, 5 or 6 hours to write a column edit it and so forth. But I was so outraged and just sort of, I just felt that murder so viscerally and so ashamed of my own sort of complicity and sort of like closet homophobia just from growing up in West Philadelphia, and just my unconscious sort of like the fact that I hadn't written about what was happening to that community really felt like an indictment. And so I sat down to write this thing, and I've never written anything so quickly and with such fury in my life, even since then. And it must have taken me all of 25 minutes to write this. And so I was really proud of it. Because I after I wrote it, it felt like it was a gift that was given to me, and that it said everything I ever needed it to say. So this is from October 16th, 1998. As crucifixions go, yours wasn't particularly tasteful, was it, Matthew Shepard? You were a wisp of a man, 110 pounds, and at 5'2", not that much taller than my oldest boy, who isn't even 10 yet. But there was something about you that a couple of rambunctious boys from Laramie took exception to. So they caved in your skull with the butt of a gun, burned your body, took your money, and left you for dead on a barbed wire gibbet on a back road in Wyoming. Because we're a country that favors the death penalty, they didn't see anything wrong with exacting a little death on someone who allegedly made a pass at them at a bar. Boys will be boys, and anything can happen in the heat of a moment stoked by the fires of hatred and bias. What was it about you, Matthew Shepard, that inspired such tenacious sadism from two local losers? Did you speak Arabic to them or say something impolite in Italian? Were you showing off one of the many languages you'd master as they drove you to your doom? What did they say to you as they made their intentions clear? Did they hold your soft features against you? Did they make exaggerated lisping sounds as they beat you into unconsciousness? Did they scream fag as your blood stained their clothes like a Rorschach test for fiends? At 21, your life must have rolled out of you like a gentle souffle. After nearly a day battered and frozen on a bloodied fence, I hope you were able to hear the celestial music in that big sky country. I hope the stars were some consolation to you as you said goodbye to the world. I wonder if you'd be surprised to learn the boys who killed you haven't hidden behind ritual denials or alibis. It's a tribute to their upbringing that they didn't try to blame a black carjacker. But what a shame homophobia isn't as much a vice as armed robbery in a land where the buffalo used to roam. Boys raised on the plains of Wyoming, the same plains that you gave up your ghost, know something about responsibility. They know how to take life's little murder raps like men. That's why they'll confess with their blood-smeared shirts on to amoral girlfriends. They know what they did. Self-deception is for city slickers. In Wyoming, murder is murder. Everyone knows what they're doing when they bury evidence. That's why they get all weepy and repentant when they finally get caught. Better to get it all out when cornered and retreat into manly stoicism when the trial starts. How else are you going to look tough but vulnerable for the 7 o'clock news? Meanwhile, no one's going to waste the state's time with a long and costly trial. Who's going to get them off on a technicality anyway? Johnny Cochran? As long as killers can claim to be heterosexual men whom God apparently loves above all others, they won't sink too low in the prison hierarchy. Despite the eerie symbolism of your murder, the righteous gay bashers who fill the pews of many of our churches aren't about to cut you any slack. As a sign of the breakdown of compassion in postmodern America, your crucifixion is a bit too obvious for them. To the politicians, preachers, and pot-bellied bigots who feel your very existence was an abomination, you're just another degenerate that got what was coming to him. Nature was simply taking its course. What's hateful rhetoric got to do with it? If only you could answer that in your own words, Matthew Shepard. All right. So it's your turn, Jimmy. Thanks.